Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Hazen Jihu. I'm a senior program manager at Amazon, and I'll be your host and moderator for this evening. At this time, I'd like to thank PARC and welcome all of our Commonwealth Club members. I strongly encourage those of you who are not Commonwealth Club members to join, as the club brings you over 75 programs per year. For more information on these, you can visit the materials table out the front or our ever-popular website, www.commonwealthclub.org. Each month, the club offers a wide range of programs and travel opportunities to choose from. Upcoming events, such as on Wednesday, October 8th, Steven Pinker, linguist and Harvard University professor, will share his thoughts on the evolution of writing and language. This program will be held at the Oshman JCC Center in Palo Alto. On Wednesday, October 22nd, Stephen Johnson will talk about his new book and PBS series, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Changed the Modern World. This program will be held at the Cupperley Theater in Palo Alto. For more information on these and many of the upcoming programs, again, the material tables has lots of information, and our website, commonwealthclub.org. For those of you who are not familiar with the club format, we have these question cards. So please write your question on here, and one of our volunteers will come by, so just hold it up, and they will bring it over to me, and we will get them to the guest tonight. Also, this event is being recorded for radio, so we'd like everyone to turn off all of their cell phones and anything that makes noise. If you could do that now, please. And all of these recordings, they are broadcasts or podcasts, and they go on a number of local radio stations, like KQED FM 88.5 on Fridays at 8 p.m., and KLIV AM 1590 on Thursdays at 7 p.m. So I'll pause for a few minutes, or a few seconds, and we will start the recording. Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Hazen Jihu. It is my pleasure to introduce Joshua Wolfshank, author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovations in Creative Pairs. Joshua is a curator, essayist, and author. He has written for a number of publications, including The Atlantic, where his essay, What Makes Us Happy, was the most read article in the history of the magazine's website. In his first book, Lincoln's Melancholy, was named one of the best books by the New York Times and the Washington Post, and won awards from the Abraham Lincoln Institute, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and the National Mental Health Association. Joshua is advisor to the Moth, is vice chair emeritus of the board of directors. He currently serves on the general counsel. He is a past director of the Rose O'Neill Literary House at Washington College and consults to the Erickson Institute for Education and Research. Joshua has taught creative writing at the New School, New York University, and Washington College. Joshua's honors include a Rosalind Carter Fellowship in Mental Health Journalism at the Carter Center and the Frank Whitney Scholarship at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. He is also a nonfiction literature fellow at the New York Foundation for the Arts. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Joshua Wolfshank.
Thank you, Hazen, and thanks to everyone for coming. I'm going to read a very brief passage that's the prelude to this book, Powers of Two, and then talk you through some of its findings and themes. Prelude. On March 29, 1967, around 2 p.m., John Lennon came to Paul McCartney's house in London, and they headed up to Paul's workroom, a narrow, rectangular space full of instruments and amps and modern art. The day before, they'd started a new song meant for Ringo Starr to sing. Today, they intended to finish it off. Hunter Davies, a columnist with the Sunday Times, was on hand, and his account offers a rare window into how John and Paul worked. John took up his guitar, and Paul started noodling at the piano. For a couple of hours, Davies wrote, they both banged away. Each seemed to be in a trance, until the other came up with something good. Then he would pluck it out of a mass of noises and try it himself. Are you afraid when you turn out the light? John offered. Paul repeated the line and nodded. They could begin each of the verses with a question, John suggested, and he gave another one. Do you believe in love at first sight? He interrupted himself. It hasn't got the right number of syllables. He tried breaking the line between believe and love, between believe and in love. Do you believe in love at first sight? Putting a pause in long enough to create the right rhythm. It didn't work. How about, Paul said, do you believe in a love at first sight? John sang it and instantly added another line. Yes, I'm certain it happens all the time. They switched the order of the lines and sang them over and over again. Would you believe in a love at first sight? Yes, I'm certain it happens all the time. Are you afraid when you turn out the light? It was now 5 o'clock. John's wife came by with a friend. They talked about the lines to the song so far, and in the midst of the chatter, John said almost to himself, in answer to what's seen when the light is out, I know it's mine. Someone said it sounded smutty. They chatted some more. Paul started improvising on the piano before breaking into Can't Buy Me Love. John joined in, shouting and laughing. Then they both began to play Tequila, a 1958 hit by the Champs. Remember in Germany, John said, we used to shout out anything. They did the song again, with John throwing in new words at the crescendo of each line. Knickers and Duke of Edinburgh and Tit and Hitler. They both stopped all the shouting and larking around as suddenly as they'd begun it, Davies wrote. They went back very quietly to the song they were supposed to be working on. John sang a slight modification of the line they'd agreed on. What do you see when you turn out the light? Then he answered the question, I can't tell you, but I know it's mine. Paul said it would do, and he wrote the lines on a piece of exercise paper. Then he wandered around the room. Outside the window, the eyes and foreheads of 6 girls could be seen as they jumped up and down on the sidewalk of Cavendish Avenue, trying to catch a glimpse over the front wall into Paul's property. John began to play a hymn on the piano. After playing with his sitar, Paul went to his guitar where, Davies wrote, he started to sing and play a very slow, beautiful song about a foolish man sitting on a hill. John listened to it quietly, staring blankly out the window. Paul sang the song over and over again. It was the first time Paul had played it for John, Davies wrote. There was no discussion. It was now about 7 o'clock. They were due soon around the corner at the EMI studios on Abbey Road. They lit a joint and passed it between them. They decided to call Ringo and tell him they would do the song that night. So thanks so much to the Commonwealth Club for having me and Hazen for moderating the discussion. I am an essayist, and that means I ask questions for a living. I wrote a book called Lincoln's Melancholy that proceeded from this question, how do we reconcile the coexistence of profound suffering and enormous achievement in the same man's life? About 5 years ago, I became preoccupied with this question, what is this thing we call chemistry or synergy or electricity? And this came from a personal place. I was curious about my experience of feeling like a different person in certain people's company and feeling a continuum from the dreadful and awful and my thoughts so stuffed up that it's, you know, as though I have the flu, to feeling light and springy and bouncy, feeling sharper and funnier, and able to do much more in someone else's presence. I immediately thought of my editor with whom I'd done Lincoln's Melancholy as an example of someone with whom I had good chemistry, and it occurred to me that this could be a question to work on for a book, and because we had this experience working with Lincoln's life as a text to answer this big question, I immediately thought, why not look at eminent partnerships as a place where this chemistry clearly exists? So I began to think of collaborators, James Watson and Francis Crick, who co-discovered DNA, the choreographer George Balanchine and his last and greatest muse, Suzanne Farrell, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, of course, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. But very quickly, I began to have some names with some question marks. I began to see bits of narrative that challenged my understanding of where collaboration lay, and I began to see the presence of a category of person that I would come to call the hidden partner. Many people know, everyone knows, George Lucas, among the best-known filmmakers and storytellers in history. Very few people know his wife, Marcia Lucas. They were married all through the early stages of George's career, and I will put George's in air quotes, when he in quotes, American Graffiti and Raiders of the Lost Ark in the original Star Wars trilogy. She was an accomplished film editor. She cut Taxi Driver, among other films. Martin Scorsese called her the best editor I've ever known. And she made enormous and very distinct contributions to the plot line of the Star Wars movies, among others. She was one of the very few people who was able to criticize her husband. And beyond that, she was played a very potent presence, drawing out a shy, introverted man who had a very hard time talking to people and warming him up and building a bridge between him and the world. Mark Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker in those movies, says she really was the warmth and heart of those films. We know Martin Luther King, of course, but we know very little of his relationship with Ralph Abernathy, who was his partner from the very beginning. The Montgomery bus boycott was devised around dinner tables at one or the other's home in Montgomery. All the way to Memphis, King referred to Abernathy as his best friend and cellmate in a profile in Time magazine. And when King died, he was on the balcony of a motel room that was known as the King Abernathy Suite, because they stayed there so often, and that's both a poignant detail of their intimacy and an indication of the trouble that often comes with these hidden partners. So much happened between these men in private, in motel rooms, in car rides, in jail cells. And while it's absolutely clear that there was something primary. King designated him as his successor, referred to him in his last speech as my best friend in the whole world. There was a quality to the relationship that was puzzling, even to the inner circle. We can also puzzle somewhat over the relationship between Vincent van Gogh and his brother Theo. How do we name this relationship? It's typically named, Theo is typically named as Vincent's supporter. And we get the image of some kind of technocrat somewhere, you know, sending checks and possibly, you know, being a sympathetic ear to his brilliant brother's trouble. In fact, according to Vincent, there was something much more happening. He once wrote to his brother, "Now I feel that my pictures are not yet good enough to compensate for the advantages I've enjoyed through you. But believe me, if one day they should be good enough, you will have been as much their creator as I, because the two of us are making them together." Theo was a very prominent an accomplished art dealer, and in fact was doing extremely well in his career when Vincent began his career as an artist and was struggling quite a bit, and was not only his financial supporter and his dealer in a technical sense, but was also his aesthetic partner. And there was an entwinement that was much deeper than the word supporter indicates. And the art dealer is an interesting phenomenon, because it's not just that Theo van Gogh as a person was hidden, that role of the dealer is one that is often hidden from public view, not necessarily as a matter of injustice. It may be a matter of critical strategy for the art dealer not to be known, so the public can engage with the artist as auteur. And that shows up over and over again. The book editor is a role that is hidden to anyone who is not an insider. The band manager, the COO. I was once talking to a fellow who was a professor of business who had me for a talk, and I was discussing this problem with him, and he said, "Well, do you know about the caddy?" And I really thought he was joking with me, because I'd recently seen the movie Caddyshack, and I thought he was just picking the most absurd example of, you know, two people happen to be side by side, but of course there's nothing creative happening. And he said, "No, I'm serious. You know, according to the PGA rules, the golfer has to go out alone. He can't talk to a coach or a manager. And so the caddy becomes, much more than a bag carrier, becomes a strategist reading the green, a kind of psychologist reading the mind of his golfer and bringing out the best in him." And he cited the example of Tiger Woods and Steve Williams. And indeed, over 12 years and 13 majors, Williams was not only a strategist and counselor, he sometimes taunted Tiger to get his blood up when he thought he needed more energy. And there was a period of years where he deliberately misled him, because he saw that Tiger was overshooting. And so he would tell him, for instance, on one critical hole, he read that it was 95 yards to the green. He told him 90 because he expected him to overshoot, which he did indeed do, and he came within 2 feet of the flag and went on to win the match. So we have overt partners, obvious partners like Lennon and McCartney, and we have hidden partners, but there are also a number of partnerships I encountered, whether partnership is just the right word, I'm not sure, but a number of critical connections I discovered, a number of illustrations of what I came to call creative intimacy between two people who are each known, but for a distinct body of work. C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien never co-authored anything of significance, but one could argue that they co-created each other, and this form of literature, this mythic parable soaked in Christian imagery, Tolkien said of Lewis, "He was for long my only audience. Only from him did I ever get the idea that my stuff could be more than a private hobby. But for his interest and unceasing eagerness for more, I should never have brought The Lord of the Rings to a conclusion." Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe are another example of distinct creative people who nevertheless were entwined beneath the surface. Picasso and Matisse. These relationships can take many forms. They may be asymmetrical. Someone may clearly be the boss and someone working for him or her. Someone may clearly be the dominant creative presence and the other person is supporting or facilitating, or so it seems. These relationships may be serial. There may be a number of intimate creative dyads in any one creator's life, or they may be parallel. It may be that you have a creator who is like the hub, and there are many spokes coming off of these creative relationships. They're very often hard to name. The key quality is a kind of heat, and I love this image from Paul Klee where we see two figures, and between them is this arrow with its pulsating red, and they're both sort of lit up because it feels to me that this shows in a very basic way the kind of heat, the kind of arousal that can happen between two people, and also the vulnerability that is implied. So I spent 5 years studying all manner of these relationships, deliberately very, very broad. And I want to say that you've already heard many characters mentioned, and you'll probably hear a few more before the talk is over, and certainly before we're done with our questions. There are many characters in this book, and the book tells their story from beginning to end. But the central character is the reader, is the listener. All of these stories are intended to illustrate convergences, and those convergences are intended to suggest to you the possibilities of how this may play out in your life. So I'm a storyteller. I tend to see the world as oriented around stories, and when it came time to make sense of this, in all of the bits and pieces I was seeing, it seemed natural to organize it in terms of story. So I began by asking, where did these people meet? Literally, what was the moment that John Lennon became aware of Paul McCartney? And Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, and what happened next, and what happened next all the way through to, you know, what's the last piece that we can see of them? When is the end? Or if it's ongoing, how do we characterize that? And I came to see these six essential themes that take us through this story. The first is electricity or chemistry, the sense of spark, the sense of energy, and it is often immediately palpable, but it may have an enormous range in terms of affective experience, using the term from psychology to refer to the way we feel. Electricity may feel like we're a little toy car and we haven't had a battery, and someone puts a battery in us and suddenly we're zooming across the floor. It may feel natural and easy, entirely organic and pleasant, or it may feel like we've just gotten an electric shock. Very often pairs in the first moment, the first thing they do is go at each other. So you have C.S. Lewis going home from meeting Tolkien and saying no harm in him, only needs a slap or so. And you have Sergey Brin and Larry Page meeting and immediately breaking into a fight. A journalist described their initial encounter as two swords sharpening each other. Electricity may be immediate. There can be a kind of creative love at first sight. But what happens next is a long and often very slow and halting movement from two individuals who are affecting each other, but each in his or her own orbit, to a collective, to a we. And when you see the first person plural begin to be used, that is as clear a sign as we have that this is happening. But very often, when we use the first person plural in our creative lives, there's a kind of movement between first person plural and first person singular, as I experience with my book editor. Sometimes it's my book, sometimes it's our book. And that is a sign that you've entered this territory between the I and the we that all pairs need to negotiate. There's often a long, slow movement to trust that I describe in the book, and this movement in language, too, and coming to speak to each other, coming to read each other in a special way, perhaps developing a private language. And all of these kind of top-level indicators of something very fundamental that's happening, which is the cognitive structures of two minds becoming entwined, which has a great deal to teach us not just about creativity, but also the way that we experience ourselves as individuals and as a collective. Following the trajectory, we're now into the heart of the creative work. We've seen the pairs meet. John Lennon and Paul McCartney was 1957. We've seen them move to a place of collective identity, often actuated by the formal moment when they need to sign a contract and give each other, give their collective entity a name and ascribe who gets what in terms of money and credit, as John and Paul did in 1962. We're now into the heart of the work, and the critical thing in understanding how two people work is, the best word for it is dialectics, and this is a fancy way of talking about two distinct things coming together and forming something bigger than either on its own, and the need to pay attention to these two distinct things. So another way of talking about this, a more mundane way, is to talk about roles. It's absolutely essential to understand who does what in a partnership. It may be a kind of temperamental thing and a quality of approach to the work, as with Lennon and McCartney. One was more likely to be questioning structure and pushing against boundaries and moving into a kind of relentless place of honesty and exploration, where the other was more likely to be looking for structure and form and tradition, and how do you encase these things? How do you take the medicine of a beautiful idea and put it into the capsule of a form that will actually deliver it into the body of popular culture? It may be a matter of training primarily. One person is an engineer and the other person is marketing. It may be that one person is doing the creative work, in quotes, being out front performing, while another person is off stage facilitating, supporting. But I think we make a formal mistake when we define creativity as the job that happens on stage, and we make the person on the wings something else and something other, when in fact creativity very often arises in the exchange between those two roles. The next stage is distance, and this is the theme that surprised me the most, because I expected, once I was deep into pairs, to see, you know, two hands totally intertwined, just connection all the way through. But I saw over and over again that these great and mature creative partners at the height of their work needed to negotiate implicitly or explicitly, consciously or unconsciously, the right kind of separation from each other, and that they thrived in a very particular kind of distance. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who co-created behavioral economics, came by it naturally. One was a morning person and one was a night person, and they met every day for lunch. It may be, like many writers, that it needs to be much more aggressive and a move towards solitude and days or weeks or months at a time spent alone before bringing a manuscript to a responder, to a friend or a colleague or to an editor. Lennon and McCartney were practically inseparable in their early days. They were constantly on tour and in hotel rooms next to each other and on tour buses and on airplanes. In the mid-1960s, they moved about an hour away from each other and began to lead very different lives. So the geographic distance and a kind of psychological distance were coincident with one another. And this was the time that their work began to flower. Now, there are many things happening. They were more practiced. They were more successful. They were more confident. But the distance played a critical role because they each burrowed into their own caves and brought out of it these very distinct contributions that reflected their particular sensibility, then brought them to the other for refinement and for polishing, and brought each other these little fragments very often that became drawn out into songs. And yes, they were songs of a very distinct quality, and we all take pleasure, those Beatle geeks among us anyway, of identifying the John songs and the Paul songs that flourished in the distance. And yet an essential part of the optimal distance for the two of them was meeting very regularly, as they did in the scene that I began with this evening, meeting and languishing away for many hours at a time and feeling very unselfconscious. And after this scene, they went to the studio and spent, they would typically write all afternoon and go to the studio and be in the studio all night. Tension and challenge is inherent in partnership because we need from the beginning to be with someone who is, yes, sufficiently alike to speak a common language and have shared values and vision, but we also need someone who is very different from us, who's going to challenge us and help us see the world in a new way. And that dialectic of a kind of cooperation and mutual support and also opposition and challenge, it grows throughout a partnership, and it comes to a height of articulation in the fifth stage, which you could refer to as tension. Certainly conflict is a major part of the stage. I call it the infinite game, drawing from the philosopher James Carse, who says there are two ways for people to interact. There's finite games, which have rules and are bounded in time, and the point is to determine a winner or loser. It comes to an end. It's very clear. And there are infinite games. And infinite games are unbounded, and they have no rules. The rules are made up on the fly, and the point of the game is to continue playing. You very often see partners in a series of infinite games trying to top the other, trying to outdo the other in a friendly or not so friendly competition. But the purpose, the real purpose, is not to vanquish the other and send him away or her away. The real purpose is to elevate their game. And you see people coming into this this very deeply sympathetic relationship at times with people who are overt competitors. And this is one of the things I alluded to at the beginning when I say these partnerships can be very hard to name. What do we do with a story like Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, who came into the NBA together? They already were gunning for each other. They were constantly thinking about each other. Bird would go out every morning in the season and immediately get the newspaper and check and see what Magic had done the night before. And he lived for the possibility that he might meet Magic in the finals. He wanted to beat him. He took pleasure not just in winning, but when Magic was suffering after a defeat. And yet they became entirely entwined, and they elevate each other. Bird said that he would be out on the court, and he would be taking his practice shots. He would take 500 shots, and he would be exhausted and ready to go home. And he'd say, you know what, I bet Magic's out there doing 800 today. And that dynamic you can also see in the relationship of Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse, trying to top each other, trying to outdo each other, and coming to a place where the other seemed really the only significant person in their life, not collaborators in any traditional sense, certainly, And again, quite hard to name just what's happening, but clearly playing an infinite game with each other and experiencing certainly this core quality of creative intimacy. This tension can be hard to bear. A great deal of what happens between partners is knocking them off stride. If you have perfect stability, there will be no creative growth for sure. Ideally, you have something that we could call dynamic stability, a kind of stability in a broad sense, but that comes from a lot of changes and a lot of turbulence. The Wright brothers had this quality in their interaction, and they also had the insight that that's what would make a plane fly, not putting it up in the air and rocketing it through with as much power as possible, which was the dominant idea at the time, but putting up something that was light and agile with a little bit of power, but a lot of flexibility to adjust to surrounding conditions. Very often, it becomes hard to adjust. Two people going at each other, experiencing tension and conflict will very often come to interruption, and we have to ask, what happens? Why do these things go wrong? Why do they come to an end? Well, it's not necessarily that they have gone wrong. It may be that they have lived out a natural lifespan. Maybe that they have done what they could do as partners and are ready to move on. It may be that they have come to a place of conflict and stoppage where there is something very basic to learn. I did find that creative partners tended very often to stumble, and I use that image to suggest that by the very forces of the very same force that accounts for their progress, they will naturally fall down. And I also found that pairs are very often affected by what I called a wedge, which is something coming in from surrounding them that gets between them and causes a fissure. And this is the moment in the story when we have to draw our camera way back and see that while no man is an island, no pair exists outside of a context either. And very often, in the pairs that thrive, you see the critical role of supporting players in the wings. And in fact, if you want to understand what happened to Lennon-McCartney, I think the critical piece is not the dynamic between them, which was certainly dynamically stable or dynamically unstable or moving between the two all the way through, but the dynamic was set quite early on. A lot of struggle and a lot of joy, and in the late 60s, the world around them, around that dynamic, changed very dramatically and very quickly. From within the band, George Harrison, who had been a very stable third presence, supporting the songwriting work along with Ringo Starr, George began to buck his role, and he didn't want to be the quiet sideman anymore. Their manager died, and they neglected to replace him, and women began to enter their lives in a new way. For young men, it's very natural that your best friend and your bandmate is your primary partner with no real question. But for a man in his mid-20s, moving to his late 20s, new questions arise about life partners in a traditional sense. And they fell apart. I use the word interruption to refer to this last stage because there is no proper end to these relationships. Once someone has gotten under your skin and in your head in the way everyone I've described so far has, that is an ongoing phenomenon. But the work may come to an end. And yet the work, I think, may be subject to what the marriage researcher John Gottman calls repair, returning to the source of joy and the source of connection that buoyed up the relationship to begin with and that can overcome the challenges that may interrupt it. With that, I want to thank you very much for listening, and I very much look forward to hearing your questions and talking with Hazen. Thank you very much.
As I look out in the audience, I see everybody came here with somebody already. So I guess everybody has their pair. So I heard you just mention a little bit you're a Beatles fanatic.
A Beatles geek.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a constant theme in the book. It starts off with Lennon and McCartney. It actually finishes with Lennon and McCartney. And I wonder if that relationship just epitomizes, in some aspect, all six of the categories. You could just go through and say, oh, these guys just fill the bill for each one of these.
Yeah, they do light up all the themes and in dramatic fashion and in a recognizable fashion. A lot of the book, I looked at hundreds of pairs, and I was looking at hundreds of pairs trying to understand what are the common themes, what are the convergences, and that made up the iceberg of the book. But as with an iceberg, you can only see about 10% above the surface, and with a book, once I had gotten to an understanding of what happens over and over again, I needed to illustrate it, and I was looking for stories that did that in a accessible way, in a dramatic way, in a way that people could relate to. Now, I can certainly relate to them, loving their music and really feeling them palpably, for all the joy and also all the heartbreak.
Because you mentioned also in the book a quote here that John was struggling with this beginning in the relationship. Do I bring Paul into the band to make the band stronger?
Yes.
Or do I move away from this relationship so it makes me stronger? Is that something that pairs really have to struggle with early in the game?
Not everyone, but it's certainly a common struggle. We certainly, and some of us more than others, have a strong sense of individual ego and what's mine, for myself. John also was an alpha. He was the leader. He didn't want that questioned. And he enjoyed a position of overwhelming dominance over players. This is when he was 17 years old. The other kids were clearly not as good as he, not as sharp and not as ambitious. And he saw this guy who he knew was going to challenge him. And he said, "The question is, am I going to take him on?" And I love that phrase because he may have meant it as, am I going to hire him? Am I going to engage him? But also take him on signifies, getting into the ring, which he was going to do with Paul. He did it very decidedly. He said, I want to have something bigger than me. And yet that question is not settled once and for all. It often is returned to over and over again. Who am I and what am I doing and what's mine and what is this collective? And that tension can be actually a very fruitful tension. And as the movement between the individual and the partnership can be very fruitful and energetic.
And as they moved from electricity all the way down to demise, not really demise, I guess, but could you see it, the relationship reflected in their music? Could you see at their high point when they were, really clicking that their music was just better than it was maybe in later stages?
I think you can, in a number of ways. I mean, you see each of them able to go further than they are able to on their own, with the help of the other, with the implicit challenge of the other. A lot of the innovations in the sound of the Beatles in the mid '60s came from Paul. Who was enormously engaged with the avant-garde. He was the one who first got into tape loops and, brought a lot of those ideas to the band. I think that was him competing with John, who was, considered the smarter of the two, and trying to impress him and trying to please him. And he would, take these sounds and bring things to light, including pieces of John's that were, very flat musically, very interesting as poetry, but quite outside the vernacular popular music. Paul had an ability to translate and to draw that out, and John had an ability to take Paul's songs, which tended to be very polished and very pleasing, and he had an ability to sort of knock it off stride and inject an element of surprise or interest, or send him back to the drawing board to make it better.
So there's an enormous number of examples of pairs coming together and how they came, and it can't all just be chance. It just can't be, oh, I just sat down with somebody at the coffee shop and this wonderful relationship bloomed. And you talk a little bit about magnet places.
Yes.
So people have great ideas, they want to bounce it off, but they're really not so sure where to go. And even one of our audience members, you know, before stage one, how do you find, identify yes. creative partners?
That's a great question. You know, a lot of times they're in our lives already, and it's a question of noticing them. A lot of times our spouses are actually functioning as creative partners but are not named in that way. Or a lot of times we have colleagues with whom we do work, and we recognize that it's a collegial relationship, but we don't think of it as one that deserves the kind of attention and scrutiny as our friendships and our romantic relationships. The classic beginning for a lot of the folks in my book who I'm following, from the dawn of their careers, is through some kind of mutual interest, and it's can be very mundane. Two people, are both into electronics, and a third guy says, "Oh, you guys ought to know each other," and that's how Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak met, and it suggests that one thing to do, obvious as it sounds, but sometimes the obvious, it's helpful to make it explicit, is to identify your interests and talk to people about it. The other very common thing is to meet someone at a magnet place, which is an extension of the same theme. The places where people go who share a certain interest. Universities, coffee shops, conferences, places where you'll find like-minded people. And the beautiful thing is that once you're in a pool of like-minded people, and you with people who share your values and aspirations and are interested in the same field, then you can look for the second piece that's essential in these meeting stories, which is who is the person who's going to challenge you the most? Who's the person who's actually, at the writers' conference, or let's say, the poetry conference, to make it even more explicit, who's the person who is doing the thing that is as far from you as you could possibly imagine? And possibly even the thing that pisses you off the most, that energy from a place of commonality is often the energy to pay attention to. And that's a piece that we may neglect and that may not come through in a world where virtually all of our attention to relationships comes through friendships and romantic relationships. We tend to think about like-mindedness and not about that spark and that opposition.
And do you think the pairs have to be project or career, or maybe more project related than maybe career or aspirational related, that you can have? For example, one of the audience members asked, did you have a pair? Are you a member of a pair? And was it for just this book or your entire career, or has your pair changed?
I will answer the question about myself and the book. I want to say what first comes to mind, which is not necessarily. Sometimes two people get together because there's a kind of organic interest in each other as people, and the work comes next. When Christo and Jean-Claude met, he had an art practice, and she identified, out of her love from him, identified a place that she could play in his work, and she became his collaborator. And she said, I can't remember if she used plumber or dentist, but she said, if he had been in one of these other fields, I would have done that too. And she developed to the point where she was certainly the co-creator of those works, and was a hidden partner until they made the decision to co-credit their work, both going forward and retrospectively, as Christo and Jean-Claude. That was quite a long ways into their career. I did have a partner for this book. My editor, who I alluded to at the beginning of the talk, was certainly its co-creator, and he was the editor of my last book. And it's an extraordinarily intimate and joyful and vexatious relationship. I get into that at the end of the book. I often was tempted to stop the focus on these other pairs and turn it on he and I, because it was the partnership that I knew the best. And I thought that was very clever. But I came to a place where we got into some real conflict, which is also a primary theme of the book. And there was a period where I thought I may be unable to finish the book about creative relationships because my creative relationship is is not succeeding. And from that place, wrote the epilogue to the book, trying to connect with this personally and help people see that this is, not just a story for, the Mount Rushmore type pairs who are, about whom encyclopedias are written, but is an everyday story and is one that can be extremely messy. Whether he and I, are a lifetime pair or not is an intriguing one, and it goes to another theme in the book, which is distance. I'm now in a place where, having finished this project, and the constant question of this project is, where do he and I meet? How do we come together? Where is the convergence? I'm now in a place where, as the writer, it's my role to go back into my cave, to go, traveling the earth, looking for the stories that appeal to me and the structure and the voice, and then to bring it to him for his response. And we have, certainly an emotional agreement, and also there's a legal framework for the way that works in the world of books, which is, he has the formal right of refusal for whatever I do next. So it's up to me to initiate it, and it's up for him to respond.
And you talked quite a bit about personalities and the different sort of roles people can play, and politics comes up. And do you see, like, there's a lot of battling going on in politics, even today and forever. But do you see this playing a role in, like, president, vice presidents can make a nice pair? Or, Reagan, Tip O'Neill were nemesis, so to speak, but they had to work across party lines. Would they be falling into the pairs category?
I think this is not a major investigation in the book. I made the decision to avoid politics because so often, what seems creative to one person seems destructive to the other, and I wanted to avoid that. But I have gotten the question and do intend to look into it, and I suspect I will find there what I've found in many fields, which is very often these large sort of impersonal phenomena, that just seem a matter of super personal forces sort of above the personal do come down to individual connection. And I think if you were to look at Nelson Mandela, who is a classic, lone genius type and who was buoyed up by relationships with Walter Sisulu, among others, there is a study to be made of his relationship with de Klerk, which was oppositional and also one of deep alignment that allowed that great passage to happen, and I do think it's poignant in a challenging way that President Obama seems so uninterested in a certain kind of cultivation of relationships. He seems to look on it with distaste. As though it's somehow beneath him, when I do think it is in politics, as in science, as in all of the arts, the real engine underneath growth and change.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking a lot about pairs, but people are curious that many things have happened or seemingly happened with just more than two. Like,
yes,
if you look at some, comedy troupes like Monty Python, or a group of, crazy comedians. It's hard,
yes,
to tell who's in charge, first of all, but tremendously good success.
Yes.
Or we take these large initiatives like the moon landing or the Manhattan Project that,
yes,
that create a lot of genius underswells.
Yes.
How can we have groups? Like, can we have four be a couple of pairs together? Can we have 30 people and get the same kind of chemistry that we see at the level of two?
So a lot of what I'm trying to do is draw attention to creative intimacy and relational dynamics as they play out in creative lives, encountering the relentless image of the solitary individual. And very often, the group is the relevant unit of study. I mean, you do need to look at Monty Python and the six of them and what they're able to do you know, as a sixth son. But from that mothership, there also were pods of dyads. There were two writing partnerships within Monty Python. And they would go off and do the sketches and bring them back for consideration and discussion and development. Within the Impressionists, Monet and Renoir went off as a pair and brought their work back to the circle. And that is extremely common. It's also true that when you look at a threesome or a foursome, you often can break it down in ways that are extremely helpful and not to be reductive, because it, you know, often the group level analysis is essential, but I think it can be very helpful because we are organized around dyadic relationships in a basic way, and it's something that we can conceive of. It's something that we can pay attention to, where groups very quickly are bewildering. It's quite hard to see everything that's going on. With a pair, you can get it down to a place where you can understand it. It is also true that the pair is an unusual unit. It has unusual potency because it is a social unit. So our whole world can be there. You can be in your own reality that's co-created with just two people, and yet it is also enormously fluid and flexible. Two people can take roles and switch roles and move from solitude to connection in a very fluid way. And the moment that a third person comes into the room, things may become more structured and more stable, which can be enormously valuable, but it doesn't have quite the same dynamic energy.
And you were talking about roles. You put them, I think, nicely in the book, talking about the star. We all see the star in the headlines and on TV, and we don't see the director or the producer. There's also, you had one, the liquid and the container.
That's right.
The liquid's kind of chaos, can go anywhere, but the container is sort of the more grounded or less, maybe I'd say less spontaneous, but more controlled or more grounded.
That's right.
And then you have like the dreamers and the doers and the generators and the resonators.
Yes.
And these are great sort of interludes between people's personalities.
Yes.
Any one more dominant than the other?
Not necessarily. I mean, and it's often surprising, you know, in the star and the director, we will associate the power with the person we know, but very often that person is taking, you know, his or her cues from the person off stage. Hitchcock, who was himself a director, was actually directed by his wife, who was the sort of CEO of his enterprise, and people said, though he was an enormously dominant figure and beyond dominant, was one who actually abused his power to a shocking degree, that between he and his wife, she bossed him. So the power dynamics are a huge conversation in the book, but they very often confound our expectations.
And a lot of, because a lot of the pairs seem to be in the arts, some in the science, but like a lot in music and a lot of in the movies. And an interesting question from the audience, what do you feel about the use of substances? You know, being a muse by themselves or in conjunction with a human muse. So many artists use opiates, you know, which lead to their own downfall, but can also bring in creativity, like Charlie Parker did some of his best work. How does that play into the pairs if somebody's involved with that?
That is interesting. I mean, I'll connect that with your last question about the liquid in the container. Just a brief background, we're used to thinking about personality types. I found that there are certain relationship types, certain interactions that recur over and over, and the ones that are truly fundamental and truly constant, I think we can consider to be archetypes. And this connection between the liquid type, who's sort of pushing against boundaries, and the container type, who pays attention to form and structure, is very typical. It's very often the case that liquid types, want to use substances. They want to use anything to change their state. They're constantly, wanting to get out of their body, wanting to get out of whatever situation they're in. And very often, the role of the container is to mind that. I mean, it's Paul McCartney would organize John Lennon's poetic lines into popular music, but he also was a guy who was around that kept him from going too far. And he said explicitly later on, when he'd left Paul for Yoko, and he briefly left Yoko, he said, I didn't know what to do with myself. I need to have someone around who says, that's quite enough, John. Let's get back to it. And you do see a lot of, enormously vital, creative people flame out. They do great work in their teens or 20s, and they're dead from an overdose. And you have to ask, where was this? You have to ask, what might have happened had there been a kind of supportive presence, someone who could stay in the ring with them and stay engaged with them, who could speak their language enough and get their sympathy enough. And then that, I think, leads us to question the value that we have on the manager or the spouse, perhaps, or the good friend who, in successful careers, we're very likely to write off, oh, well, anyone could have done that. Well, if anyone could have done it, if it was so easy, then why didn't Andy Kaufman have someone like that who was able to keep him in the game, or Janis Joplin, or Jimi Hendrix? It's not actually so easy to do.
Mm-hmm. So if these, let's say McCartney and Lennon, if that pair had not really got together, and maybe Lennon to make a different decision not to bring Paul in the band, would you think it'd be as equally successful if you had a McCartney and Elvis, or a Lennon and Jagger? Are there other potential combinations that could have got you equal greatness? Like, you don't just get one shot at a pair, I hope.
That's fun to consider. No, I don't think you just get one shot, and I think I don't think we should, overwhelm ourselves by thinking, oh, there's only one person for me, and oh, geez, I it's been 30 years since I was 15, and I didn't meet him then, so. I think this can happen at all stages of life and in all forms, and I think it's actually very best to start very small and pay attention to the little feelings in which we are buoyed up. The person that we have, on a scale of 1 to 10, who we have a 6 of chemistry with, as opposed to a 2 or 3. At the same time, there was something. We should not underestimate the significance in these great creative lives. John Lennon did say that if it weren't for the Beatles, he would have ended up like his father, who was charismatic and vivacious and a ne'er-do-well who couldn't hold down a job. And he was already well down the path of delinquency and a life of crime, where I say in the book that he was on a way to a place where his primary relational partners were going to be his probation officers. Mm-hmm. And it took someone who could channel him and hold him to allow that power to come to the fore.
And do you think maybe an area like the Silicon Valley is maybe a mecca for these kinds of pairs to get together? It brings sort of one of our magnet places? Or does the internet play such a huge role with social media and Skype? You can be anywhere in the world. Does it change the definition of how to maybe find your pairs or where pairs might congregate?
This question of technology is a really urgent one. It's playing such a huge role in our lives, and when you ask creative people, about their day-to-day lives, it's a primary struggle. It may be the chief struggle: how to work with email, how to work with text messages, how to carve out enough time of real meaningful interaction. It is telling, and I discuss this in the discussion of distance in the book, that the very companies who are profiting from virtual interaction do not favor it in their own organizations. And so you have Yahoo having prohibited working from home. When the Google HR chief is asked, what's the ideal telecommuting? He says, as little as possible. And the power of direct person-to-person engagement is extraordinary. The data that's exchanged beyond language into qualities of voice and quality of language is really, really powerful. And many people find that it's essential. That said, you know, all of these things that all of these tools are just that. They are tools for us to negotiate our connections and disconnections from other people. And they can be enormously creative. I mean, certainly email exchanges will be in records at universities. Email exchanges between editors and writers and between collaborators and perhaps records of Skype chats, you know, alongside the letters of another age. And it very often is the case that, you know, the technology of distance actually facilitates the right kind of connection. But it's different for every person, and the same tool that you can use to, you know, augment your creative life can also be a great way to disrupt it. You have to ask yourself honestly how it's working for you.
So as people get more successful, and you've talked about some of these wedge issues and there's outside influences, maybe
yes.
Third parties, money plays a big part in it. As people become more successful,
yes.
More successful, they tend to not be so cooperative.
That's right.
And how do you balance, you know, between sparring and, you know, trying to get creative juices to flow and destructive behavior?
Yes, it is challenging. I mean, certainly, you know, one hindrance to, you know, creative progress can be a lack of success. You know, if you never get recognized and it just doesn't take off, and you know, if you can't support yourself, that itself could be a wedge. It very often also works the other way, that, you know, two people who've been enormously successful together and who have been able to, you know, cooperate when times are hard, find that money and credit and fame are to be apportioned out, and it stimulates a kind of greedy impulse. There is a lot of social science that shows that, you know, thinking about money tends to make us think about the self and what's me and what's mine. And a lot of fantasies of wealth are fantasies of being able to disconnect from other people. This New York Lotto ad above the Holland Tunnel that, you know, shows, you know, all these people sort of, you know, cramming into this traffic line, and then the guy who's got his own, you know, his own separate tunnel, and they say, you know, you could be like this guy if you won the lotto. It's actually, I think, a fantastically sad image. I mean, yes, who wouldn't mind getting from New Jersey to New York more quickly? But it suggests, you know, that we have the power to isolate. Mm-hmm. We don't need other people. We can, spend money on things that we might otherwise need to develop relationships to get. And that is it may seem appealing to in the short term, because relationships can be challenging and taxing. But it ends up being absolute death creatively to disengage from people. And One of the big problems is when someone gets so big and so fat in their mind that no one can say no to them, and they become immune to the kind of push and pull out of which a great work occurs. At the same time, this is one of the things that great pairs do for each other, and that they can continue to do for each other at any level of success. You know. You're never too big for me to tell you that that's a stupid idea, and you see very often you see people paying more attention to those relationships, not less. I heard from a famous film director who had a, you know, major success at a young age. And he said, I'm not going to name the movie because it was off the record. But he said, I can't trust anyone that I met after this movie. Mm-hmm. Because he never knows who's toadying to him and who's currying his favor, but he knows that the crew he came up with, because he understood that they were with him before, he can trust them after.
That level of authenticity,
yes.
As you move through your career. Well, unfortunately, we've come to that part of the program. We just have time for one question, one final question. And we'll see if you can set the path for some young minds here.
Okay.
If you were a third grade teacher... how might you apply a couple of your learnings and insights in the classroom?
That's a great question. Really good question. There's several ways I can go at this. Let me just start with the thing that feels most relevant in my life. We'll see how long I go on about this. I may finish with it too. I think we all are third graders with respect to creative connection. I think we all need to learn the lessons that are very, very fundamental. And I think it's a complicated set or a delicate mix of kind of overt lessons and things we see repeated over and over again, and internal experience and intuitive experience. And what I try to do, in my own, third grade learning about creative connection in my own life, is to really just pay attention to the quality of my experience with other people, and then to pay attention to how that translates to the work. It's an astonishing thing, and I asked the question at the beginning of the project, and I still am mesmerized by it and intrigued by it. And though I've learned a lot about it, I still, find it an awe-inspiring question of, how is it that people can draw something out of us? When I was a kid, I used to play with these toys. You don't see them so much anymore. They have a kind of plastic body with wheels and a little mechanism and a long serrated piece of plastic, and you would sort of put the plastic at the front and draw it through, and that friction would set the wheels going, and it would sort of dart off across the floor. And I often feel that certain people, have that quality for me, and I think, it may be just in the very slightest thing, like, that was remarkably articulate what I just said, or that is an unusually apt way of framing this problem, or this person has just taken a question that I've been wrestling with and has really offered a novel way, or this is someone who I'm not talking small talk with in an environment that's full of small talk and politeness, and seizing on these little moments, and then cultivating them, and whether you're a small child or a large child, that is the place where this begins, and recognizing that in one way or another, whether you're being activated in your work or you're going to join a common project in name, this is the story behind so much of the creative achievement we value, and such a critical and underattended factor in the creativity that we aspire to.
Well, great. Unfortunately, we do have to close the program, but thank you so much
for
talking with us.
Very grateful.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Joshua Wolfshank, author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovations in Creative Pairs, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.